transformation in trials. Welcome to Transformation in Trials. This is a podcast exploring all things transformational in clinical trials. Nothing is off limits on the show, and we will have guests from the whole spectrum of the clinical trials community. And we're your hosts, Ivana and Sam. Welcome to another episode of Transformation in Trials. Today, we're going to dive into the topic of ensuring representation in clinical trials of patients from lower income backgrounds. And in the studio with me, I have Sam Whittaker. Hi, Sam.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sam is on a mission to identify and eliminate the barriers for people to participate in clinical trials. So it's the perfect guest for this specific topic. Now, Sam, setting the stage for us, can you tell us more about which background the typical clinical trials patient has?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the there's kind of two parts to that answer. I think the first is current state. If we're thinking about who is actually involved in clinical trials today, it's, you know, and we're trying to profile or generalize, 80% of trial participants in the US, almost all of the statistics that I'll reference are US specific. Mm-hmm. But in the US, 80% are white, most are men, and there is a predisposition to be able to or willing to participate in a trial if you earn over $50,000 a year. So I guess the inverse of that would be BIPOC communities that are earning less than $50,000 a year.
And when we think about what this does for the clinical trials that we run, what are some of the problems with having this specific type of population that typically participates in a clinical trial?
So I don't know. I don't think that the issue really revolves around income directly. The larger issue that has been, I think, brought to the surface as a result of COVID and the vaccine studies is that having participants concentrated in a single group, let's call them white Americans earning over $50,000, is great for white Americans earning over $50,000. Drugs are tested on that patient population, and if approved and they make it to market, we know that they are safe and effective for that subsegment of our broader American population. The issue that is not, I think, not like a obscure one is that a lack of diversity in trials essentially erodes the integrity of the drug development process for all Americans. You know, more simply stated, and I think that there's a quote on the FDA's website. I'm going to paraphrase it. That we essentially have to test new, you know, pharma products in the patient population that is essentially going to use them. Otherwise, how can we be certain that they're effective or safe? I think oftentimes we also, so this is ultimately a conversation about diversity, right? And as we get into this conversation, we'll start to make some really clear connections between income levels and the lack of diversity that are in trials. Diversity is a complicated issue in our country. And I think that that concept or that term is almost instantly associated with racial diversity, which is certainly a component of this conversation, but it is not limited to simply an inclusion of certain racial or ethnic groups. We also are attempting to also include people with a diverse set of medical conditions, mental health statuses, pregnant women, people who suffer from a substance abuse problem, and so on. So, you know, and I think that the excluding or effectively not actively excluding, right, but effectively boxing out a significant number of Americans as a function of low income also prevents us from testing new products on their patient population.
That makes sense. A curious point is that we often compensate patients for participating in a clinical trial. Why do we do that? And how does this impact this challenge?
So on the surface, I think that most people probably assume that any sort of payment that's made to a participant is an exercise in incentivizing them to participate. If you listen to the radio or you see an advertisement, oftentimes you'll hear at the end that you might be compensated for time and travel, which is like a very general, kind of like statement, that deliberately, excludes or navigates around the concept of incentive. But, those are marketing, advertisements that are trying to feed the top of the recruitment funnel. I think that the idea of offering up compensation is like a carrot to help, right? And I think over the years, there's just been like a general lack of critical thought around payments and what their purpose really is and how they impact the broader drug development process. So I think that on the surface, it seems like it's incentives, right? Mm-hmm. But actually, if you dig into this, the vast majority of participants are operating at a net loss. And I think that like generally speaking in the context of a conversation about payments, I'll slide phase one studies aside. And we can talk about that later or another time. I think I'm specifically talking about the larger populations that are going to be enrolled in studies beyond phase one. Most patients are operating at a net loss. If you think through all of the possible expenses that are associated with being a participant beyond the very superficial, like, you know, parking garage expense or gas or even mileage, there's quite a lot, including, you know, childcare, tolls, there may be hotel expenses that were not contemplated by a study team when they were constructing the ICF or other expenses. And I think that the interesting thing about how we like construct essentially a framework for each study is that we don't consider the individual circumstances of a participant. So your expenses associated with participation and mine are almost guaranteed to be different. They might be profoundly different, but it's probably unlikely that they're exactly the same. But the payment schedules that are provided to within the ICF that are ultimately delivered to patients and the caregivers, if there's a payment at all, are the same across the board. And if we dig into that more, right? So first, payment is not required. So there is no requirement that a participant receives any form of payment at all, whether it comes in the form of a reimbursement or what we would typically think of as stipend. And if I back up for a second, I'll tell you that payments aren't uncommon in clinical trials, and they typically get bifurcated into two different types. Reimbursements, which as it implies, is a reimbursement of expense incurred, and stipends, which is kind of like this like catch-all concept in clinical trials that is typically a flat amount that is provided to a participant for the completion of like a defined milestone. And most commonly, it would be a site visit. The issue with stipends is that they are also synonymous with income as far as the IRS is concerned. All of the funds that you receive in the form of reimbursement would not be taxable, but all of the funds that you receive in the form of a stipend will be aggregated, and you will be responsible for reporting that from dollar one, and you'll get a 1099 from the payer after you exceed $600. And I think it'll become clear why that is problematic, not only for the individual for the prospective patient, but also for the industry and the issue of diversity. Mm-hmm. So backing up, going back to my example, the vast majority of patients are underwater as a function of their participation, because unless, you know, unless their personal circumstances are fortunate, right? The, you know, $25 in like reimbursement for parking and then another $50 in stipend might cover my expenses. But in today's world, it is likely that it does not cover my expenses. And there are plenty of examples to kind of reference. I think one of the other interesting things that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about is kind of like the economics of trial participation in the context mm-hmm. of payments. So as your diagnosis trends towards a terminal diagnosis, mm-hmm. your demand for experimental therapies becomes inelastic, which then mm-hmm. allows for an environment where sponsors don't have to pay a participant, even though financially the participant may be significantly worse off. You know, and I think that it's interesting because I think that is effectively an exercise in like leveraging desperation in order to coerce a patient to do something that is going to make them worse off financially. And I suspect that this is not the intention of the framework, but has like developed. And I think that the lack of critical analysis of the downstream impacts of how we operate in this way have just been overlooked, or nobody's spent the time to go back and take a look at this.
How has our current thinking about compensation for clinical trial participation evolved? Where does it come from?
It's actually a good question. I'm not sure I know the origin story of where the first payments came from. I think that at some point along the line, and this may have been from the very beginning, there's been like this hyper sensitivity around coercion, or this idea that if we pay patients, that the payment, we have to make sure that the amounts are not so large that they coerce a individual to stay in a study and continue on a treatment that may be not in their best, the best interest of their health. And I think that that is a very smart concept on paper. I suspect that in current day, that probably doesn't happen very often. And I think that the kind of the data that that I kind of referenced at the beginning about who is participating in trials supports that. You know, I think that the difficult thing about this concept of coercion and protecting patients is that there is no defined framework to evaluate whether or not a payment is coercive or not. So an IRB will review an ICF and all of the other materials that they would typically review. In the ICF, there should be reference to payment or reimbursement. And then it's simply a subjective decision by the reviewer or the reviewers at the IRB. There was a person that I talked to earlier this week who used to be associated with an IRB at a large research university. And she was telling me that, you know, coercion can be different depending on who the participant is. And that, you know, a certain amount might not be coercive for a generally more affluent population, but the same amount may be coercive for a lower income population. And I think that she was attempting to educate me. But I think I was consuming that and I was thinking to myself that this is like exactly the problem that exists. Mm-hmm. And we're saying like, you know, $100 or $200 might be appropriate for you and I, but it wouldn't be appropriate for, let's say, a single mom on welfare. Interestingly, our expenses, your expense to go to the study and the single mom who's on welfare, assuming that you guys live in the same city or you're the same distance, is the same. I think that we're like essentially failing to be thoughtful about how we approach this. And there is no guideline, and it's completely subjective. And inevitably, the biases of the reviewer are at play in their assessment.
I want to dive more into what is the exchange that is actually happening between the trial sponsor and the trial participant. What is it that the sponsor company is trying to do? And what is it that we as sponsors need the patient for? And what does the patient need us for?
So, right. So I've also been thinking about this in the context of just general product development. So, you know, I think any company that generates or like produces a tangible product will generally follow this framework of, you know, design, develop or build, and then you test the product, and you probably repeat that for a while until it's satisfactory. And then you would go into a commercialization phase where you sell your product to people who want it or need it. The pharmaceutical industry is no different. They design a product, build it, test it, and then they commercialize. The process is regulated, and the testing phase is clinical research. And so when a sponsor gets into the testing phase, they will go through the process of going from one phase to another in clinical trials. The, I think, unique dynamic that exists in the pharma space compared to other spaces that produce products that are high risk, like the auto industry, or you can think of like bulletproof vests, for example. The thing that's unique is that the unproven product has to be tested in humans. Mm-hmm. And through that process, the sponsor collects data in order to find out if the product is safe and or effective. And in order to make sure that the product is safe or effective for the consumer, the FDA, who's essentially the third party regulator, kind of oversees this process and makes the final determination. Ultimately, the sponsor is after data from the mm-hmm. participant. And the data that the participant generates or provides is the value that is being sought after by the sponsor so that they can navigate the testing process, get their product to market, and generate sales. Mm.
So if we think about the exchange that happens here, the sponsor does get a lot of value for having the patient participate in the trial. And the way that we think about compensating patients is more very specific towards the site visits that they have to go to, and not so much in the broader context of what is the value that is actually being exchanged.
That's right. And I think to get back, I forgot to mention the second point, right? So like, what's in it for the patient? Like why would a participant enroll in a study? It's typically not a function of profits or generating profits. I think that in most cases, there is some sort of medical issue that the participant needs help solving. You know, whether it's I think a friend's father who's like generally healthy enrolled in a some sort of cardiology study, and it wasn't because he was bored, and he also wasn't terminal. He just has a heart issue, and his doctor referred him to a study where there was an investigational drug that could help him. So he did. I think there's a spectrum of severity. You know, we can go from like a teenager who's got really bad acne that is looking for a solution to acne. And I don't mean to like minimize that scenario. But I think relative, like on the spectrum where on the opposite end, we have, let's say, you know, an ALS patient or a terminal brain tumor patient where there's no standard of care.
I'm curious to go back to the topic you started before about the IRB evaluating the payments that will be provided to the study participants also. Does the IRB, is it part of their role to ensure access to trials or what is their mandate?
So the IRB is responsible for essentially looking after the human participants and essentially preventing them from being harmed in the process of human research. They, you know, as far as I, you know, unless I have missed something, they are not responsible for ensuring access. I think that at a high level, and I read this directly off of the HHS website the other day, but I'm forgetting it word for word. But essentially, they are responsible for making sure that the patient's safe or their well-being. I think that was specifically the word that was used on the government's website, is that they were, among other things, responsible for the well-being of the participant. Mm.
But currently they're the only organ that tries to evaluate, you can say, well, the well-being of the patients in a trial. There is no other body evaluating the payment that we provide to patients. Is that correctly understood?
Yeah, I think so. And I think as far, like, you know, you know, with regard to an IRB, you know, I think they're in place to make sure that, you know, one or more research sites are compliant with regulation and that there's nothing, you know, essentially funky going on that would put the human participants at risk. And I think that in the context of evaluating payments, I suspect that there's very little time or effort that is spent contemplating payments in the context of a patient population. I think it's simply a matter of subjectively doing a review and thinking, is this coercive? And if the answer is no, they move on to the other components of the proposed research. I think that what they are failing to consider is not so much, I think that they do a good job of answering the question, is this money, is this amount too much for this patient population? But they, I've never heard once an IRB come back to a sponsor or a CRO and say, hold on, this isn't enough for this patient population. You're not providing any compensation for this cancer participant. You only have two sites. You know, they might be coming from a long way. You know, that is, it's not appropriate. You're going to exclude a large number of participants, and the ones that are going to be able to participate may end up being essentially harmed financially, which I don't think is like a matter of like, well, they're not going to have as much money at retirement. I think that there's lots of examples of families who participate in trials, can't afford it, but the people like friends and family or communities will raise money and help them to help to financially support them. The failure of the IRBs to protect participants in this way, may not have an obvious relationship to diversity. But, and I think that diversity is a complicated issue. But the thoughtless nature of the evaluation of payments in clinical trials, I think, has a direct impact on this. Outside of not paying enough, right? So I think there's like two primary issues that exist, right? So I think that there's no requirement to make a payment to a participant at all, not even to reimburse them. And certainly not to, you know, pay them like a minimum wage or something like that, despite the value transfer. There's also no consideration for the way that payment is being delivered. And I don't mean that like tactically, like a check or something else. I mean, structurally. So if a sponsor is willing to pay $100, it wouldn't be uncommon for the sponsor to pay $50 in reimbursement and $50 in stipend, which is like a relatively arbitrary division or structure. So there's like the two issues are, is $100 enough per visit? It might be for some people, it might not be for others, although nobody is asking that question. The second is, how does that structure impact the participants or prospective participants? And so every dollar that's delivered in the form of stipend is taxable, whether or not you are profiting or losing money. So you may lose $19,000 or $17,000 in a trial, and you may have received $1,200 in stipend. you're still going to have to pay tax on that stipend, which is not the, not the intention of like the tax code. Because a stipend is considered taxable income by the IRS, it threatens about 110 million Americans. And how does it do that? Right. So there's about 110 million Americans that are enrolled in a social welfare program. So you can think Medicaid, food stamps is, I think the next largest single program. And then there's others as well. I think about a dozen other programs. Each of those individuals qualifies for their welfare program because they make less than a certain amount of money. And so naturally they make a small amount of money and the government is assisting them. And so any dollar of income that they receive from an outside source, could threaten their eligibility. Right. And so I think that, like, practically speaking, most people that are on welfare, like, have a pretty simple analysis in their mind. And they think, I have to stay away from taxable income because it might put my, you know, Medicaid or my food stamps at risk. The reality is that, you know, if you are low enough income, you probably can participate in the study, generate some income and not be at risk. Mm-hmm. But like, if we're talking about, you know, what actually happens in the real world, when a welfare recipient enters into a research site because they have acne or they are terminally ill, they oftentimes will not enroll because it puts the welfare that they rely on at risk, or they will drop out mid-study before $600 is paid to them, because it's also a common perception that you don't have to pay taxes until you reach $600, which isn't true, but that practically speaking, that is common. Or worst of all, the third option is that they would participate in the study and just refuse to receive any sort of payment, which then puts them in an even worse position than they otherwise would be.
So it sounds like people may be hit twice, that lower income people may lose out on the opportunity for treatment and also and or lose out on the opportunity for getting reimbursed or receive payment for participating in a clinical trial.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of fallouts. You may lose money participating in a trial. You may not be able to participate because you might not be able to afford it. Or in the case of a welfare recipient, you may not be able to participate either because you can't afford it or because if you do, you are going to lose your public housing or your food stamps or some other benefit. So then I think that when we like zoom out, right, and reflect on why is it that 80% of clinical trial participants are white, mostly male, and earn over $50,000, right? I think that, you know, there's probably many variables that contribute to the current state. But it also seems obvious to me that, you know, like simply stated, it's easier to participate in a trial if you've got a bunch of money. And if you have not so much money or very small amount of money or no income, it's really difficult, if not impossible, to participate. And, you know, I think aligned with the mission of the work that I'm doing, you know, this seems like a big barrier. I don't necessarily think that if we eliminate this barrier, that suddenly trials are going to be flooded with diverse participants, but it allows for the other work to include those participants to happen.
That makes sense. And I also know that you are working on several ways of addressing this problem. Can you tell us more about those?
Yeah, I mean, we are working on a couple of different ways to eliminate the barrier of taxation for participants. The first, and I think personally, maybe the most interesting thing that we're doing is back in late summer, I engaged a lobbying firm and we drafted a legislation that will exclude all payments to clinical trial participants from tax. So any amount that you receive as a function of your participation will be exempt from taxation and effectively eliminate the threat to your welfare program. And if you're not in a welfare program, it also, you know, I think is reasonable to exclude taxes because of the reality that the vast majority of participants are operating at a net loss as a function of their participation. That's been a really interesting process. In late October, we kind of publicly released the letter that that I wrote, and then started talking with the staffers of senators and representatives in the House of Representatives. I didn't get any sort of objection, really. I mean, there were some staffers that didn't understand clinical research, but nobody was opposed. Eventually, we did find some sponsors for this legislation, and we drafted and finalized a legislation. And funny enough, I think the legislation is expected to be introduced to Congress this afternoon, sponsored by...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I mean, there's no guarantee that it'll happen today, but last I heard, it's supposed to be introduced today. Sponsored by a Republican representative, Mike Kelly, and a Democratic representative, Chrissy Houlihan, both coincidentally from Pennsylvania. And so
that's
that
also
is
an
like,
achievement, having both parties support the same bill.
No, I know. And, you know, I think that was our goal. You know, when we started this was to make this a clear cut benefit for everyone, regardless of your politics. And I think that we've had support so far from both parties, which has been, to be honest, refreshing for me. This is like a firsthand example of, I don't know, the system working so far. I think that we have a long way to go before this is actual law, but you know, it feels like we are making progress, and there are at least a handful of people in DC that understand and care about this issue.
That's amazing. And super interesting to follow whether this happens today and what the outcome is going to be. I am also interested to learn more about maybe on a more general level. We have two authorities that are impacting each other here. On the one hand side, the FDA does want to encourage more diversity in clinical research for many reasons. And at the same time, we have the US tax code, which is in this situation actually removing the incentives for more diversity in clinical trials. How can we resolve the differences between the two?
Yeah, I mean, it's just an interesting unintentional conflict of interests, right? So, you know, if the way that I've been like visualizing this in my mind is that, you know, if you think of like the federal government as like a large corporation, you know, made up of functional areas, right? Like you've got like your, I don't know, call it like your revenue department, and they've got certain rules, the IRS, and then you have, you have the FDA, right? An agency that's responsible for health in your large corporation. They both have mandates. They both have initiatives that they're working on, but it just so happens that one prevents the other. And it's entirely unintentional, but it exists. And I think that one of the things, and this is one of the reasons why this legislation is, I think, making, you know, kind of natural sense to a lot of the politicians that we've managed to put it in front of. You know, I suspect that the IRS hasn't considered this, and I also suspect that the FDA isn't all that aware of it either. I spend a ton of time thinking about payments to clinical trial participants and the implications of payments, but I don't think that there's probably large numbers of people like me that think about this like very, you know, niche, nerdy part of the world that there's a lot of other, you know, problems to think about. So, you know, my hope is that, you know, maybe somebody on at the FDA either sees this podcast, hears about the legislation, reads my letter, or, you know, I think that eventually, the lobbyists that we're working with will, approach the FDA, and, we'll be able to hopefully get their support, pretty easily, I would imagine. The truth is that, the amount of tax revenue that's generated from stipend payments to participants in trials is like effectively zero. It's not actually zero, but like relative to the government of the US or the budget, relative to the budget of the US government, it's essentially a rounding error.
That's some rounding error. Sam, how did you arrive to be interested in this space in the first place? What was your journey?
Originally, when I went to college, I wanted to go to medical school. In an effort to get to medical school, I did a bunch of work study jobs at the hospital. I went to University of Pennsylvania. And I kind of went like each year, sometimes I worked in labs. Other times I worked essentially as an intern for a site coordinator who was executing trials. This was how I was initially exposed to clinical research. I didn't end up going to medical school. I ended up entering into, I don't know, call it the business world out of college. I worked in investment banking and then kind of investments. And then, you know, through my own personal journey through my 20s, I like realized that I wasn't going to be successful working in like a traditional corporate structure, and found myself working at a startup that was developing payment technology. Ultimately, I wanted to start my own tech company, and I knew a little bit about payments, and I knew a little bit about clinical trials, and I had an idea to develop a product that eliminated the 6-week process of a university cutting a check for a participant. So I quit my job, started a company called Greenfire with my best friend from first grade and my wife, and we built a prepaid debit card product called the ClinCard, which is, I think, today, essentially the market leading, you know, prepaid debit card solution that is used by a lot of, or maybe most, studies. So I think ultimately, to answer your question, like the last 15 years I've spent thinking about patient payments, how to make them, what are the, shortfalls of debit cards, how, you know, if you were to evolve them or innovate them, what would you do? I just kind of accidentally found myself, you know, kind of 15 years later, having spent all this time, you know, kind of critically analyzing the situation.
Well, I'm very happy that you have. This is definitely an area where we can improve, both in the US, but I think also taking a worldwide perspective. Well, we are going to start rounding off, and I'm going to ask you the question that we always ask our guests in the end. And that is, if I gave you the transformation trials magic wand that can transform one thing in the life sciences industry, what would you wish to change?
If I could have one wish, I would wish that all trials would be accessible to all individuals. And so ultimately that everyone who could benefit or wants to participate in a trial would, one, know that the trial exists, and then two, be able to participate in that trial, or at least assess it and decide for themselves whether or not it's appropriate for them.
That's a wonderful wish, and that would change the dynamics of clinical trials and the participants that we have, and probably the data and the results that we would get.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Sam, if our listeners want to learn more about you or reach out with further questions, where can they find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. I think it's linkedin.com/Sam Whitaker. Mural Health is the name of the company that I'm building now. You can certainly go to muralhealth.com. If you wanted to learn more about the legislation, you can navigate to diversity.muralhealth.com. We didn't talk about it, but we're also running a project called the Portrait Project, which is inspired by Humans of New York. It's, you know, think of it like the Humans of New York for clinical research.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's great. And the stories are really interesting. The real stories of real individuals that this really talented person on our team, Emily, goes out into the world and finds them, similar to Brandon from Humans of New York. Anyway, that is at portraitproject.muralhealth.com.
I will look that up. Well, Sam, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Same. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Transformation in Trials. If you have a suggestion for a guest for our show, reach out to Sam Parnell or Ivana Rosendahl on LinkedIn. You can find more episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or in any other player. Remember to subscribe and get the episodes hot off the editor.